message that she sent.
Blog Talk Radio.
I'm in your back.
Jordan, Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, April the 19th, 2024. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. And we'll, of course, later on in our program, be coming up with some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. In the second and third hours, we're going to feature the panel discussion from Electronic Intifada on the current situation in Palestine and throughout West Asia. And these and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the West African state of Ghana. This is the music of A.B. Quincel and his Super Sweet Talks. Let's listen in.
work. You need to go for cinema. I know the fool, love. I know to marry me again. Go for your family, make them marry you. Because if you tell you there, where I can't take you now. Where you dey wear every day? From in the back, where you want go to another man? Na bread and the butter na bow where you dey chop. Na in the back. I no be fool. You for go now, go, go. Angelina, don't do me so.
Mama. listen, that the way they say marry. Now marry man and marry woman. It's the same thing. Because everything where you go do, the money matter. Where from the money pocket? First, where you go to sojourn for a battle again? I mean, now money. But mind you will not be bachelor. From cold way, you will catch you for bed. Now, wow. Everything.
No money.
You go chapel.
No money.
You go single.
No money.
You go work out.
I saw some girls, they resemble my sister.
then I'll call you. The walk is where you just go. I even asked her name. She said some voice is there. I have to learn. She said some voice.
Come on. food complex. Come on the bottom, and the dog. What I said, I'm going to be our energy assassin. So you can fish your best and not open the jima, or to win one. The best swinging hotel, I've been in what, Jama. On the top of the town, top of the town hotel. I'm quite hard, I'm quite, Dr. Papa, so I said, I'm a whole friend, Dr. Kaiko. Hey, I'm the president. And a hard worker, that's my line. Miliano. What do you call Jama? Jama Faye!
Hey!
Jama Faye!
Hey!
Yanni Epo. You want to hear? You want to hear? Hey,
Oh, shit. The best brush on it you can get.
everybody did again. I do not for my, what do I do? So,
for a woman, it feels nothing. Because everything where you go do, the money matter. Where from the money pocket? First, where you go to join for a battle again? I mean, no money.
Taking it, taking it. When I see my woman, I'm not talking. never put on another for the chair and the motor. And the world shouldn't be here. Don't. Hey, you better be careful about my head. You won't break my head. What did the world drop to them? Oh, what the boy smiling as well? What if I didn't get the book? Just a second. Just a who could do joke? Who could do joke? I can't fire. And I hope you are not. What's in your face? What's in your face?
Hey.
Yamba, I don't give a damn. Just give me this, brother. Your father. Your father. Hey, how you doing? Yamba. What's up, bro?
Mama.
I want to go home. Could you have a good time? And then, what could you call like a car? Now, anybody, I'm not about the rich. I'm going to put a good jacket. You know, washing the water. I'm doing it. On what you take care of that? Yeah, what do you know? So cool. Come on. no. Say yes, you men are papa. When you go West Virginia.
Welcome back. And that was A.B. Crenshaw and his super sweet talks from the West African state of Ghana. Classic Ghanaian Pan-African music from the early 1980s. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, April the 19th. 2024, we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. And the Pan-African Newswire is a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day international electronic news service, and you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire by going to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. You can have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast by logging on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Yourself.
Sounds of the Abyssinians with the track entitled I and I. This is the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, April 19th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We have been following extensively and thoroughly the current crisis in West Asia, in Palestine in particular, the recent retaliatory attacks by the Islamic Republic of Iran against the State of Israel. Today we're going to listen to Electronic Intifada. We're talking about 6 and nearly 1/2 months of the genocide in Gaza. Let's get an update on these developments.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, April 17th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abonima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 194 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including a discussion with journalist Asil Moussa, who just evacuated Gaza with her family. We'll be joined again by Paul Bigar, tech innovator and founder of Tech for Palestine, to talk more about Israel's use of artificial intelligence and its genocide in Gaza, and how tech workers are protesting their employers' complicity in the genocide. We're hoping to connect with one of our contributors in Gaza, Dunya Abu Sitta. Later on in the program, of course, John Elmer will take a look at videos from the resistance in Gaza and the West Bank, as well as the Iranian missile attack against Israel. But first, some of the news over the past several days. Intense Israeli bombardments, including airstrikes and tank shelling, have continued across all areas of the Gaza Strip, particularly this week in and around Rafah in the south and Nuseirat camp in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Yesterday, 4 people, including a child, were killed and others were wounded when Israeli airstrikes attacked a house near Rafah. A separate strike in the Yebna refugee camp in Rafah killed 7 people, including 4 children. The United Nations reports that the Israeli army has detonated buildings, struck a market, and bombed homes in Nuseirat, central Gaza, over the last week. On Tuesday, armed Israeli quadcopters shot at children in Nuseirat. Reports emerged that the drones have not just been shooting at children, but loudspeakers on the quadcopters hovering over Nuseirat refugee camp are broadcasting sounds of babies and women crying.
بسم الله ونعم الوكيل طبعا جنس من الصوت اي حد بيطلع امبارح استشهد شب بدا ماسكين يشوف ايش الصوت في المدرسه طبعا بدا والله اذا مسحوق بسم الله ونعم الوكيل.
The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor reports that this psychological warfare tactic is being used to lure civilians toward the sounds in order to shoot them. The human rights group stated on Tuesday that according to testimonies from camp residents, sounds coming from the quadcopters also include voices of women and girls screaming, "Come help me, I am injured." In one instance, one 20-year-old man speaking to the rights group said that, quote, "We went out to see what was happening. We went out to see what was happening. No women were found, but we were directly targeted by a quadcopter drone." Many residents heard these sounds and responded to provide help. Also on Tuesday, the Israeli army killed 11 Palestinian children in a drone strike. The children were inside a playground near a market in the Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. One of those children, Hamza, was the cousin of Asma Abu Mzaid, a writer and gardener who appeared on the Electronic Intifada podcast in 2022. To talk about her chapter in the literary anthology, Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on the airstrikes on Maghazi and Nusayrat from Gaza yesterday.
Horrific attack that just took place at a Maghazi refugee camp within the past 45 minutes or so. A drone fired the missiles on a group of people. Later on, we learned it from eyewitness in the area that this were a group of children at a playground that was set up near a camp for displaced families. And those children are regularly visiting this playground. And just as a father of three children, I understand why displaced families would send their kids just for an hour or a couple hours just to keep them entertained and release all the negative energy in them, because right now displaced families have the hardest time inside tents or inside other people's residential homes trying to stay protected and safe. But it's as necessary as also staying safe just to give space to those children. So 11 children have been killed in this attack, and just one wonder what threat these children had posed to have the Israeli military fire a missile drone on them. 11 reported killed, with dozens of injuries in the area. Those who had the scene of the attack described horrific scenes of the children torn apart by the massive explosion caused by the missiles.
That was Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reporting on Tuesday. In Gaza City, in northern Gaza, at least 7 Palestinian police officers and 2 bystanders were killed on Tuesday when the Israeli army attacked their vehicle. The police officers were protecting and organizing the distribution of humanitarian aid, according to Gaza's Interior Ministry. The United Nations warned this week that food and humanitarian aid supplies were being prevented entry by the Israeli army and stated that, quote, "We can't stress this enough. The occupying power's obligation to facilitate aid does not end when commodities are dropped off at the border." Over the weekend, Israeli quadcopters fired on Palestinians, including families with children, who were attempting to walk back to their homes in northern Gaza after being forcibly displaced for the last 6 months. One video captured by a Palestinian journalist shows a mother holding her young daughter, who was shot in the head by an Israeli quadcopter-fired bullet. Medics with the Palestine Red Crescent Society published a video of their ambulance team who treated children shot by the quadcopters when they were trying to return to their homes. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated on Tuesday that the Israeli army, quote, "deliberately attacked thousands of Palestinian civilians on Sunday, killing and wounding dozens of them, and continuing its crime of forced displacement by preventing civilians it had previously forced to evacuate, including women and children, from crossing from the center and south of the Gaza Strip into their areas of residence in the northern regions, despite the end of hostilities in most of these regions. These actions may be considered crimes against humanity and war crimes." Euromed added that, quote, "as thousands of displaced people attempted to cross via Wadi Gaza Bridge, an Israeli military checkpoint on the coastal road known as Al-Rashid Street, to return to their residential areas in the northern strip, Israeli forces killed at least 5 Palestinians, including a woman and a girl, and injured dozens more. Other Palestinians have been left missing due to the chaotic scene." Euromed Monitor received identical testimonies confirming that the Israeli army forces fired tear gas bombs, live ammunition, including from quadcopter aircraft, machine guns from naval boats, and artillery shells directly and deliberately towards thousands of civilians trying to return home. Despite news circulating on social media about the Israeli army's condition-based permission for the displaced to return to the northern Gaza Strip, the displaced said they were surprised to be targeted directly and arbitrarily on Al-Rashid Street, the rights group said. Elsewhere in northern Gaza, Israeli tanks surrounded a primary school that was turned into a shelter for hundreds of Palestinians in Beit Hanun and shot at people inside. While the official number of Palestinians killed since October 7th is approximately 34,000, according to data gathered by the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, human rights groups and Gaza's Civil Defense Corps are estimating that an additional 13,000 Palestinians are missing. These people are either under rubble and debris, buried in indiscriminate mass graves, forcibly disappeared in Israeli prisons and detention facilities where some have even been killed, or their bodies have been taken by Israeli forces to unknown locations. Children continue to bear most of the brunt of Israel's engineered starvation policy. On Sunday, a video circulated showing children who were recovered from near drowning off the coast in Khan Yunis while they were swimming to retrieve aid dropped by planes, which landed in the sea, while humanitarian aid trucks remained stuck at the few border crossings because of Israel's refusal to let them in. The World Food Program and other UN agencies were able to deliver fuel enough for just 4 days to restart operations at a bakery in Gaza City. Most of Gaza's bakeries had been unable to operate due to conflict and lack of access, according to the World Food Program. Since October 2023, the Gaza Strip has been under an electricity blackout after the Israeli authorities cut off the electricity supply, and fuel reserves for Gaza's only power plant were depleted. Kamal Ajour, a bakery owner in Gaza City, told the World Food Program that, quote, making bakeries work again will bring back life to the Gaza Strip. The UN emphasized that in recent months, northern Gaza has largely been cut off from aid and has recorded the highest levels of catastrophic hunger in the world. In mid-March, the Global Nutrition Cluster reported a near doubling of malnutrition rates among children under the age of 2 in northern Gaza. In southern Gaza, Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis partially reopened following a 40-day siege by Israeli forces, which forced hospital staff to suspend all services last month. The Palestine Red Crescent Society, which is headquartered at the hospital, stated that services are limited to the emergency department only due to the extensive damage inflicted by the Israeli occupation forces, making the operation of other departments impossible. While Palestinian medical heroes reopen parts of hospitals, the United Nations reports that the health situation across Gaza remains dire. The largest medical facility in Gaza, Al-Shifa Hospital, has been completely destroyed, as we've reported over the past few weeks, and a vacuum in healthcare provision has been created, the UN says, following the destruction of Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza, which was once the second largest referral hospital in the Gaza Strip. The World Health Organization reported that most of the equipment and machinery at Nasser Hospital had been damaged, and the Limb Reconstruction Center, which the World Health Organization and its partners helped establish in 2019, is in ruins. The UN reports that, quote, the Nasser Medical Complex warehouse, which previously provided essential medicines and supplies to other hospitals south of Wadi Gaza, has also been destroyed. Dominic Allen of the United Nations Agency for Sexual and Reproductive Health said that the maternal and neonatal clinic is now empty, full of destruction and the smell of death. Here is Dominic Allen in a video released by the United Nations on Friday.
An interagency mission with the World Health Organization and UNFPA at the Nasser Medical Complex. I visited here in January, where we delivered life-saving maternal health supplies, and today the warehouse of the hospital is literally burning behind me. Our supplies and those supplies of WHO and partners follow the life-saving measures that are needed for the people of Khan Yunis are burning. Behind me is the maternity and neonatal clinic. Last time I was here, it was full of pregnant women, the midwife, the doctors, but also full of internally displaced people frightened for their lives. Today, it is empty. It's full of destruction. It's full of the smell of death. We are deeply concerned about the safety of the pregnant women and the women who need to come and find health services. And right now, in Khan Yunis and in the Nasser Medical Complex, there is none. We want to be able to stand up these services as soon as possible. But first of all, they need a ceasefire above everything else.
That was Dominic Allen of the United Nations Agency for Sexual and Reproductive Health. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers rampaged inside and around at least 17 Palestinian villages and towns over the last weekend, including in the Ramallah, Nablus, and Jerusalem governorates. The United Nations reports that two Palestinians, including a 17-year-old boy, were killed in Al-Mughayr and Betin, and at least 45 were injured. Some 40% of those injured were shot with live ammunition, the UN stated. Israeli forces reportedly closed the entrances to the targeted villages, tightening movement restrictions along the route between the Ramallah and Nablus governorates, and were witnessed firing rubber bullets and tear gas canisters toward Palestinians, the UN stated. The Palestinian human rights groups Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights urged the so-called international community to respond to the intensified violence by Israeli settlers across the West Bank. Settler violence against Palestinians is not a new phenomenon, but it escalated significantly on April 12th, the groups say, after a 14-year-old Israeli settler went missing and violent Israeli settler mobs began raiding occupied villages in the West Bank. On April 12th and 13th, the group state, quote, the Israeli settlers completely burned 14 homes, 13 livestock pens, a civil defense vehicle, and 3 car garages, as well as partially burning 15 homes and 4 livestock pens in Al-Mughayr village. Furthermore, 60 vehicles were set ablaze. A total of some 76 Palestinians were injured, primarily by Israeli settlers, with 18 remaining hospitalized, including 3 women and 2 children, at the time of writing. Of those, 6 Palestinians sustained serious injuries, with 3 currently in the intensive care unit. Israeli settlers further stole 145 sheep and killed 36 others. The Palestinian rights groups state that, quote, like the ongoing assault on Gaza, the current escalation in the West Bank does not take place in a vacuum. Between January 1st and October 31st, 2023, there were at least 1,038 incidents of settler violence. Since October 7th, settler attacks have more than doubled from an average of 3 to 8 incidents a day. Similarly, the rate of Palestinians displaced has more than doubled, an increase of nearly 119%, as 280 Palestinians are now being displaced on average every month due to demolitions. This is a direct result of Israeli settlement expansion, which is at its highest level since United Nations monitoring began in 2017, and Israel's illegal designation of a record amount of West Bank land has been designated as state-owned. In the Jerusalem area town of Beit Hanina on Tuesday, Israeli forces destroyed a house belonging to Khaled Mutasib, who was killed in October for allegedly opening fire on police, who chased him and killed him. The Israeli police were wounded but not killed. The Israeli High Court last month ordered the demolition of Mutasib's family home in an act of collective punishment, and not only blew up the house but sealed it with tons of concrete. Today, April 17th, is Palestinian Prisoners Day, which was established by the Palestinian National Council in 1974 as a national tribute to honor the thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli occupation prisons and to support their legitimate right to freedom. Palestinian groups including Adamir, the Palestinian Prisoners' Rights Organization, and Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights state that as of today, more than 9,500 Palestinian detainees currently under Israeli custody are facing unparalleled retaliatory and punitive measures. Al-Mizan, which has recently published harrowing testimonies from men, women, and children who have been detained and tortured by Israeli officers, states that, quote, amidst Israel's genocidal military campaign against Gaza, over 3,000 Palestinian residents of Gaza have been detained by Israeli forces. This includes individuals from various demographics, including women, children, and the elderly, as well as professionals such as doctors, nurses, teachers, and journalists. Israeli authorities are subjecting Palestinian detainees to multiple forms of cruelty, torture, inhuman, and degrading treatment from the moment they are arrested and throughout their detention. Adamir says that, quote, the date of October 7th marked a significant turning point that imposed radical transformations on the reality of prisoners and detainees in Israeli occupation prisons. This was reflected across all dimensions related to this issue in light of the comprehensive aggression against our people and their detainees, and the ongoing genocide against our people in Gaza for over six consecutive months. Throughout this period, the Israeli occupation authorities at various levels carried out horrific crimes against the prisoners, resulting in the deaths of 16 detainees due to systematic torture, medical neglect, starvation policies, and a range of violations and acts of abuse, targeting both male and female prisoners, including children, elderly individuals, and the sick, Adamir says. For more on Israel's treatment of Palestinian detainees, read my colleague Tamara Nassar's recent article, Israeli Prison System Claims Another Life, on electronicintifada.net. All over the world, activists are organizing protests, rallies, and events marking Palestinian Prisoners Day and demanding liberation for the men, women, and children inside Israeli prisons. And finally, earlier today, our colleague David Cronin carried out a citizen's arrest of Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Union Commission, for aiding the Gaza genocide. Oh, I thought, yeah, here's the video.
Thank you very much.
You expressed total support for Israel at the beginning of this genocide. The blood of Palestinian children is on your hands. You are a criminal, Mr. von der Leyen. You should be ashamed. You should not be here. You should not be running for election first. You are a war. You are a criminal. Free Palestine! Free Palestine! That is it. Free Palestine.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thiessen. Thank you very much.
That was our colleague David Cronin carrying out a citizen's arrest of Frau Genocide, as our Irish colleagues say. And that's just some of the news on the ground in Palestine, from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our crucial new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. Coming up, we'll bring on Paul Bigar to talk about artificial intelligence and Israel's military and how tech workers are protesting against complicity in Israel's genocide. And we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza and the West Bank. But first, we have two contributors to the Electronic Intifada with us. Asil Moussa joins us from Egypt, and hopefully we have Dunya Abosita in Gaza. Asil is an accomplished journalist and writes for the Electronic Intifada, The Guardian, The Intercept, Middle East Eye, and Al Jazeera English. Asil, we'll go to you first. It's so good to see you. Tell us about where you are now and your process of leaving Gaza. I know that it wasn't an easy one. Tell us about your work now and where you are.
Hi, Noura. Thank you so much for hosting me. Now I am in Cairo. I evacuated Gaza just 1 month ago. And the process of evacuating Gaza is not easy at all. Everyone who wants to evacuate Gaza should pay $5,000 for each adult and $2,500 for each child in order to be allowed to travel. Personally, after paying this money for me and my family, we had to wait for 25 days for our names in order to be included in the list that would be allowed to travel through the Rafah crossing on March 17. And actually, the process of evacuating Gaza is exhausting psychologically, you know, leaving your home and your country. And maybe we feel a little bit safe here in Cairo, but actually my friends, my family are stuck in Gaza, and they are all waiting for their fate. So being safe in another country doesn't mean feeling comfortable, and actually leaving your beloved ones in Gaza and knowing that your country is still being bombed and your favorite places are being targeted is also hard.
Hi, Asil. It's so nice to talk to you. Alhamdulillah, ala salamatkum. And
hi, Ali. Thank you.
And Asil, we've been so proud of your work over the past few months amid this horrifying genocide. And you told me how that when you were going to leave Gaza, how sad you felt about leaving your home. That's what it is, leaving your home. And all of us can understand that. Tell us about what you left behind in Gaza. I'm talking about now the immediate situation. What did you experience in the last few months, and what did the people around you experience? We've read your articles, we see the news, but we want to hear from you what you can tell us.
Okay, I left in Gaza, the rubble of my home, but I can't wait to go back to Gaza and build a tent on the rubble of my home and to stay there again. I left my friends, my colleagues, my family members. The situation in Gaza is dire. It's actually unbearable. No one can fathom being under Israeli bombardment for the seventh month, being prevented of the necessary food and the basic essentials. People now are suffering in getting milk for their children or even getting diapers for them. Everyone waits for his fate. And the whole world that knows that there's no electricity, no internet, no drinkable or even undrinkable water in Gaza. People were killed while trying to get some flour to their families. So the situation there is catastrophic.
Asil, can you, I have so much admiration for you, because you're just, you've been working just relentlessly, over the last 6.5 months. You've been writing for all of these different outlets, including the Electronic Intifada. What is it like, working as a journalist under the conditions that you have been working in, and what are some of the stories that have stuck with you the most?
Okay. First of all, I just want to say that I'm so proud to work for the Electronic Intifada, and I'm so proud to work with you, Noura and Ali, and thank you for the supporting you get to me through the month I lived in Gaza and even when I arrived to Cairo. And according to working as a journalist in Gaza, it's very hard and it's risky. And actually, I was worried about my family because, you know, hundreds of journalists were killed along with their families. And a lot of them were threatened to be killed. Actually, I was nominated by Reporters Without Borders to receive the UNESCO Can Award Press Freedom Prize. And I was told by Reporters Without Borders when I was displaced in Rafah, but I actually didn't tell my family. I hide this news because I thought if I told them, they would feel more worried. As I was nominated with Wael Dahdouh, Matab Azaiza, and Ala Zanoun, we know that Israel killed the family members of Wael Dahdouh, and it threatens Matez to kill him and even to kill his family. And actually, Ula was injured by Israel, so I was afraid to tell them. And according to the stories I wrote and through the Israeli aggression in Gaza, actually every story I write affects me very personally. I still remember all the details I documented about the suffering of my people in Gaza, but perhaps one of the articles that exhausted me psychologically when I wrote it was a piece I wrote about my friend and colleague Mahmoud Anaouk. Mahmoud was 25 years old when Israel targeted his home and killed him, along with his father, sisters, and brothers. Mahmoud was working for human rights organizations, and he was very ambitious, was very polite. I wrote that story just to tell the world that our martyrs who are being killed by Israel are not numbers. They are innocent people. They have dreams. They have families. They have beloved ones. I used to consider Mahmoud as my younger brother. And 2 days before Israel killed him, he texted me and asking me if I need any help as he was killed in Deir al-Balah. Deir al-Balah is in the middle of the Gaza Strip. And it was claimed to be a safe area by Israel, but it wasn't at all. So writing about a friend exhausted me psychologically, but I had to do this. I had to tell the whole world about Mahmoud and the innocent people in Gaza. And actually, there is another story I wrote for The Guardian. It was about the Palestinian woman. Her name was Hanan. Hanan was forced to give birth in her home without any essentials. She was assisted by a nurse who was displaced in her home. When Hanan told me the details of giving birth at home, I was like shocked and how you managed to bear all this pain. And actually, the people and the displaced people in Hanan's house used the light of their phones in order to facilitate the delivery of Hanan. So these two stories just broke my heart.
Yeah.
Allah yirhamu Mahmoud and Nauq and all the martyrs. Mm-hmm. It's an unbearable toll. And everyone in Gaza who we speak to, who we know, has lost so many friends, so many members of their families. And they often say, we don't have time even to grieve because you're just trying, yes, to survive from one day to the next. I want to show a tweet that you made just, I think, in the last couple of days. It's a very simple tweet. I think we can put it up on the screen. And it's about the sea in Gaza. You say, this is our sea, the Gaza Sea, our safe haven. Asil, I want to ask you what you mean by that. Tell us about the sea in Gaza, what it means to you and what it means to people there.
Yeah, well, I miss Gaza Sea. Even the people who are in Gaza are missing the Gaza Sea. Actually, when I was in Gaza, I didn't see the sea for 3 months when I was displaced in Al-Maghazi refugee camp, which is in the middle of the Gaza Strip. But when I evacuated the Al-Maghazi refugee camp because it was threatened to be bombed, and when I moved to Rafah, I passed by the sea, and I saw the sea, and it was like a little bit of relief. I saw the people who were sitting on the beach, while the sound of the warplanes are annoying them. So when I left Gaza and evacuated the Strip and moved to Egypt, I saw a tweet for my friend Mahad Husseini. I think she was visiting the sea, even though she is being displaced for the third time. And I was a little bit jealous that she went to the sea. We Gazans have no more beautiful place than our sea.
And the sea, during, tell us, before the war, what role did the sea have in the life of everyone in Gaza?
We have so many cafes very close to the sea. They all were bombed by Israel. It was our safe haven, as I mentioned in my tweet. It's so hard to travel from Gaza, so we spend our vacations by going to the sea. We have to spend time with ourselves very close to the sea. That means everything for us. It's the nicest place in Gaza. When I want to go out with my friends or my family or my relatives, we think together where will we go, and we then end up deciding to go to the sea. Gaza is 360 kilometers, and we can travel outside easily. So it's our only heaven.
Asil, you mentioned that you're in Cairo, you are in relative safety, you have water, food, shelter. I hope that you have all of those things. But you said you can't wait to go back to Gaza and to build to put up a tent by the rubble of your home. Why do you feel that way?
Okay, look, all Gazans who evacuated Gaza say the same thing I'm telling to you right now. They all want to go back. We don't belong to any piece of land but Gaza. I evacuated Gaza, but my soul is still there in Gaza. And I say this, my parents say this, and my younger brothers and sisters say the same thing. Actually, when I evacuated Gaza, I was with my family, and my youngest brother, whose name is Hamoud. Hamoud is 13 years old. He was very afraid and worried when we were in Rafah, especially when the Israeli occupation threatened to conduct a ground invasion. And he was asking me and my older brother, who lives in the USA, please do anything. Just help us to get out of Gaza. And I swear to God, when we arrived Egypt and we stayed in a fancy place for the first week we stayed in Egypt, he told me, if you please, can we go back to Gaza? Even the children can't fear the life away from our Gaza.
And in Cairo, I assume that there are many other Palestinians who have had to evacuate, but are like you and your family planning on going back as soon as possible. What are the conversations like with those Gazans in exile, in temporary exile in Cairo? How are you continuing to form community and solidarity there?
Actually, I'm lucky to have some of my extended family members here in Cairo. Eid al-Fitr was a few days ago. They came to visit, and we used so many kinds of sweets and coffee and some drinks. But here in Gaza, here in Egypt, we sat in front of each other and asking each other, when will we return? When will we go back to Gaza? We speak about the suffering of the Palestinian people in Gaza. We speak about the Israeli bombardment in Rafah, Nusayrat, Deir al-Balah, Maghazi, Beit Lahia, Jabalia, Tal al-Hawa. We speak about every single neighborhood in Gaza. We keep looking at our phones and following the news and making sure that our relatives are safe or not. We do nothing but talking about Gaza and dreaming of going back to our homes or even the rubble of our homes. Actually, yesterday I was with a friend who came from Gaza just 2 days ago. He was saying, I cannot even eat. My stomach just used to eat so little quantities of food. So even though here there is food and there is water, I feel I can't even drink or eat. I think of my parents who are in Gaza. I think of my friends. So we just belong to our homeland. We don't belong to.
So your parents are still in Gaza?
No, I'm talking about my friend. My parents are.
Oh, your I see. Sorry, I see. Okay, yeah. Asil, you've been writing not just for the Electronic Intifada, but for international media.
Yes.
We just showed The Guardian, and you've written for other publications as well, and it's wonderful to see your work in those publications. But have you had a chance to look at some of the media coverage, particularly the English language media coverage about Gaza? And if so, what's your reaction to it in general?
Well, the Western media gets everyone mad. And to be honest, it gets the majority of us mad. I think the Western media coverage is unfair. This is why me and my colleagues are very determined to keep writing about Gaza, especially in the Western media outlets. You know that Israel prevented the Western journalists to enter Gaza and to cover the Israeli genocide in Gaza. So we tried to do our best in order to tell the truth of our country and our beloved people. And to be honest, sometimes I felt disappointed and I work for nothing. Nothing just changes and nothing can be changed if I'm not. But I keep remembering the words of Dr. Rifat Al-Arair, may his soul rest in peace, to pushing us to keep writing, to keep posting about Palestine and Gaza. I remember that my first article was for the Electronic Post. When I asked him about his opinion and his advices, he let me feel that I did a victory when I wrote my first article. I didn't realize the importance of keep talking about Palestine and Gaza. So, but in this genocide, when I worked more for different Western media outlets, I realized his meaning about the importance of writing about Gaza and telling the truth and documenting the Israeli violations and talking about the voiceless people.
Well, Asil, your work does make a difference, mm-hmm. and Dr. Rifat made a huge difference. You know, I don't know if I've had a chance to say to you, but the greatest treasure that Dr. Rifat left on this earth is you and his other students and all of those whom he encouraged to write, to tell the stories, and we continue to honor him by doing that. You made a huge difference, and he made a difference, and we thank you for that so much. And don't stop doing it. Don't stop doing it.
Asil Moussa, you are a legendary journalist, and as I said, you know, we're all in awe of you and your work and your tenacity and your courage, and you know, we can't wait to see what you rebuild in Gaza after this is all over. Asil Moussa, please take care of yourself. We can't wait to see what you write next. Thank you so much for joining us today on the live stream, Habibti.
Thank you, Asil.
So
and we'll see you back here soon, I hope. We'll see you back on the live stream soon, I hope. Inshallah. Thank you.
Thank you, Asil. Oh, you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Thank you so much to Asil. We've been trying to get Dunya Abusitta on, but the connection in Gaza is just so unstable and fragile, so we might have to have her on next week, but we will keep trying.
And Dunya, maybe we can just show her latest article.
Yeah.
She wrote an article about the education of more than a million children and young people in Gaza, including her own education, her university education, which was basically ended.
Yeah.
She had one semester to go, and Dunya and her family have been displaced, like almost everyone in Gaza. We connected with her very briefly. We caught a glimpse of her, which was wonderful. But the connection just didn't work out. So hopefully we can get her next week or very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ali, do you want to introduce our next guest?
Yes. We are very happy to have Paul Bigger. He's a software engineer. He is the founder of Circle CI and Darklang, and recently of Tech for Palestine, a coalition that now includes thousands of tech industry professionals who support Palestinian freedom. Paul's most recent blog post is about how Meta, the parent company of Facebook and WhatsApp, is complicit in Israel's genocide in Gaza. We're going to talk about that. Regular viewers may remember that we had Paul on a few months ago, and we are very happy to have you back with us, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure. Paul, you've been following closely the revelations about artificial intelligence, and I think you also watched the discussion we had a week or so ago with Anthony Lowenstein, the author of The Palestine Laboratory, and how these AI systems Israel is using basically to assist its genocide in Gaza, systems with names such as Gospel, Lavender, and Who's Your Daddy. And there's been a lot of focus on some of the details about how these systems supposedly work. How should those of us who are not necessarily versed in the technical specifics regard these systems and the role of AI in this genocide? How would you explain that to someone like me who doesn't necessarily understand all the technical aspects?
So the way that I would look at this is that the AI is about enabling automation and about providing plausible deniability around what they're doing, because the AI is junk. right? It's complete crap. There's no basis for it. It's an incorrect application of how to use AI, and the way that the information that they use, the process they describe for creating it is entirely, you know, you should look at it as this is being used as a way to enable bombings, to enable the killing of civilians, with absolutely no connection to its stated goals.
But then why use it at all then, if it's basically junk? Why would Israel be using it? Why would they be allowing, Israeli publications, albeit on what counts as the left in Israel, to publish about it when there's so much censorship? What do they want us? How does Israel want us to see it?
I think that Israel wants this to come across as a very technically sophisticated approach to the actions that they're taking. They want us to think. I've been thinking about this for quite a while. Why is it that this article was led through the censorship? And I think the idea is that they want us to believe this 90% number. So there's a number in the article where they say that 90% of targets are that was the threshold they use, and talks at other parts in the article about lowering the threshold to increase it, but the,
just explain 90% of what?
Well, exactly. Maybe it might be good to take a step back and sort of like look at how AI works. What AI does is it produces a formula, like a mathematical formula, like 3x plus 4y, that sort of thing, algebra. And it creates this formula from past information that it has. And then it puts new information into that formula and tries to see from the answer, is someone a militant? And this is the same sort of thing as an Instagram, predicting a post that you might like, or Netflix recommending a movie. All of these models, they're called recommendation algorithms. And you can see from this that the AI, people think of AI as being something quite smart. ChatGPT looks like it can talk to you, but all it's doing is in every case, it's predicting something based on past data. It's not doing any intelligence. It's not doing any investigation. It's not intelligent in a way that a human is intelligent. And so when you look at it being applied for, is someone a militant, right? It's not verifying that someone is a militant. And in the Lavender article, they indicated that the human verification, which was supposed to be done afterwards, is not being done. But even from that, it's a pre-crime idea, right? The very concept of it is that we shall predict who we think might be a militant. And I mean, there's a whole ton of things wrong with how they're doing Lavender. The change from how data is being collected to how data is being applied is like hugely problematic. And even if it was appropriate, but the idea that you would predict a sort of like a pre-crime kind of idea. It's, at best, these are suggestions for people to investigate, and there absolutely should be no direct killing of the people suggested by the algorithm. So when you look at why is this here, it's purely to sort of like whitewash or AI wash the automation of the genocide.
There is a discussion we had with Anthony last week where, we were talking about these kinds of surveillance techs, including AI, including, biometric surveillance, and also in terms of what happened on October 7th, where the Palestinian resistance was very effective at taking down, the billion-dollar wall around Gaza, and impacting the surveillance matrix around Gaza, and it would be like very reasonable to assume that that would have an impact on Israel's tech, capabilities to sell that kind of tech on the global market. And Anthony, said that actually there's been no indication that the tech market has taken a hit, which also makes sense in terms of like global capitalism and how it works. And even if it doesn't work the way it's intended, it's still a commodity and a product that's being purchased and sold and marketed. What do you make of the Israeli tech sector? And do you think that it's self-branding as like the startup nation with all of these incredibly dangerous, lethal, and prone to mistake sort of software and tech is still being marketed?
I think the Israeli tech sector is quite large. There's 6,600 startups, I believe, in the Israeli tech sector. My main focus on it is recognizing how fragile that sector is. We advocate, we have a project called IsraeliTechAlternatives.com, and we advocate for boycotting of Israeli startups. And one of the reasons that we do this, because they are so incredibly fragile. Startups, they're only as good as their next funding, and their funding is only as good as the last quarter. So in order for them to survive at all, they need to keep this inflow of capital, to keep the inflow of customers as well. And so startups can entirely fall over by missing a single quarter. And it's something where the, even a slight fracture of the narrative, whether, of a particular startup or of the tech sector as a whole, a tiny break there can lead to extraordinary change in their sector. And so it's something, on the weapon side of things, the weapon side of things is honestly the most secure or the most kind of like fundamentally safe sector, because it's something where, kind of really doesn't matter as much as it does in, kind of more B2B applications.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable. You in your most recent blog post, you write that Meta, the parent company of Facebook and WhatsApp, is complicit in Israel's use of these automated killing systems, you mentioned Lavender. Can you explain how Meta helps Israel kill Palestinians?
So to be clear, I suggest that they may. One of the things that's discussed in the Lavender article is this book that's written by the YS is the initials that they use. And that's been identified as the head of Unit 8200. And in that book, they talk about what kind of data is being used in the system of Lavender. And as I mentioned, Lavender is using these signals, right? It's predicting on the basis of some signals, of some data about people. And one of the things that they suggest that they use is, are you in a WhatsApp group with somebody? This kind of points to the flaws in the system, right? What does it mean if you're in a WhatsApp group with someone? Right? Does it mean that you are, living in the same building as them? It might mean that you have the same soccer team as them. It almost certainly doesn't mean that you are, in the same Hamas battalion as them, because they are almost certainly not. It would be ludicrous to use to have a WhatsApp group of like, this is where Hamas hangs out. So what they're doing is they're trying to extrapolate this, who do we kill from membership of WhatsApp groups. And probably, membership of WhatsApp group is not, a solid indicator of, of is this person in Hamas or is this person a Hamas commander, which was the thing that the algorithm was originally trained on. But Meta's role is unclear. And it is very important that Meta answers it. They have not released their latest transparency report. They were supposed to have released their transparency report by now. I'm told the transparency report is not good. I don't have any more details on that. But, you know, this is something where you can look at this company that has significant leadership sympathies to Israel. You know, Sheryl Sandberg, who's on their board, is doing a sexual violence tour for Israel, pushing out that narrative that Israel has constantly been pushing on, and where there's you know, it's pretty much correct to call it a hoax at this point. Mark Zuckerberg has donated to Zaka, which, as we all know, is the group that originated a lot of the false propaganda around the October 7th atrocity porn. And Zuckerberg donated to Zaka. And also, Guy Rosen, I don't name him in the article, but you know, he's well known who he is, was a former 8200. That is their head of policy. The title is CISO, Chief Information Security Officer. And this is, you know, one of the people who is most senior in their policy decision making. I'm told he's the person most directly responsible for the suppression of pro-Palestinian content on Meta brands, on Instagram in particular. These are kind of the decision makers in this organization. And then you combine that with this, you know, what we're being told about Lavender, that this information is being pulled out of Meta. And this is, you know, a normal kind of law enforcement claim that you would make. You know, law enforcement can make requests to social media companies, obviously, to say, you know, who are people connected to, who are people talking to, what is the metadata of these conversations. And so the question has to be like, you know, is Meta supplying this information to the IDF? Is it supplying it for use in Lavender? What knowledge do they have about its use in Lavender? Because there's a great many people at, you know, especially Guy Rosen, but you know, across Meta, there's a great many people who worked in the IDF who were either IDF soldiers or in the IDF unit 8200. It's very common for 8200 soldiers to become part of the tech industry, and unit 8200 is a massive organization. So you know, there's a lot of cross-pollination there. So it's very natural to ask, like, where are they getting this information? Is Meta complicit? You know, that's really the question for Meta. We want Meta to tell us.
Yeah. And just to really clarify this, so you, Guy Rosen is the Chief Information Security Officer at Meta, which owns Facebook and WhatsApp, which pretty much all of us use one or the other, pretty much. I mean, there are some people who use neither, but I'd say 98% of us are probably using one of them. He's the Chief Information Security Officer for Meta, one of the most senior policy and decision makers at Meta, and he is a veteran of Unit 8200, which is the Israeli Army Cyber Warfare Unit, a notorious unit. And going back to 2014, there was a group of veterans of Unit 8200 who came out, I suppose you could call them whistleblowers, who came out and said that what we were doing 24 hours a day was spying on Palestinians, not spying on Hamas commanders, spying on all Palestinians, listening to their phone calls, looking for any information that we could use to help Israel. That might be, for example, somebody who was, in a sexual relationship with somebody that might be frowned upon socially, and they would blackmail them. It could be people who need medical treatment. It could, whatever it is, that's what Unit 8200 was doing, and that they would actually celebrate when the information they had extracted had been used to kill someone. So that's just to emphasize who Unit 8200 is. And now we presume that, or it's been reported that this is the same unit that is responsible for developing or producing or operating these artificial intelligence killing machines, basically. And that's who is now at, someone who's a veteran of that is one of the top people at Facebook.
And not just Facebook. You know, this is across across Silicon Valley, across tech. You know, you were mentioning earlier about, you know, how many startups and how big the tech scene is, right? This is, you know, the connections between Silicon Valley and Tel Aviv are massive, and we see it in venture capital, in small startups and in large scale startups as well. In Google, for example, a lot of the policy decision making now around you know, what should be suppressed and what not, that decision making is made in the Google Tel Aviv office. In LinkedIn, a former IDF, in fact, a former Unit 8200 soldier, Tomer Cohen, is their CPO, and I'm told is one of the most one of the person most involved in the suppression of pro-Palestinian content on LinkedIn. So this connection between 8200 and Silicon Valley is, I mean, it's celebrated in Israel and celebrated among the Israeli tech scene in Silicon Valley. It's not at all some secret that we have uncovered. It is something, you know, if someone is Unit 8200, they put it on their resume, they put it on their LinkedIn.
And just, you know, you mentioned Google, and we'll say a bit more about that in a second, but this platform that people are watching us on now, YouTube, is owned by Google, and we've had a number of our videos taken down, live streams and other videos we've put up on the Electronic Intifada YouTube channel. We never get an explanation of why, you know, we get a vague justification. Our appeals are always rejected. We've never had one reversed. And we've noticed, I mean, we can only guess why they're being taken down. People will know, for example, in a little while, we're going to have the military update with John Elmer, and we're going to show some of the videos we always show. And we take pains. We're actually extremely careful not to show anything gory, not to show, you know, the most explicit violence. And yet our videos still get taken down. Again, we don't know exactly why. And we've noticed that other channels that maybe have fewer viewers or are less prominent or sometimes more viewers are putting up very explicit content, the stuff that we don't show, that we actually take out of the videos in the hope of avoiding the censorship, and they don't get taken down. So is that just random? Is it targeting? I mean, obviously you don't know, but how are we to interpret this kind of pattern that we're seeing? And of course, it produces the effect, if we're always second-guessing ourselves, is this the thing that if we say it or if we show it is going to get us taken down? So it produces self-censorship in a way. I mean,
it's very much designed to do so. The, you know, I talked earlier about the plausible deniability as being a key part of AI and how it's used to sort of, you know, to allow the manufacture of killings and the automation of genocide with Lavender. But it's the exact same thing we see in social media suppression. There's a bunch of different systems. There's reporting, there's AI. And, you know, the AI is one of the key problems with AI is that it's unexplainable, right? We don't know why it's happening. And that is actually a key positive feature for a lot of the people who want to use it. It's impossible to say why the AI decided to take your system down. It's impossible to say why the AI decided to deny this healthcare coverage. It's impossible to say why this AI decided that this was the person whose bomb was going to be dropped on their house in Palestine. This is a core feature of AI for a lot of the people who are trying to shut this down. And when you look at Palestinian suppression or suppression of Palestinian content, there are so many different distributed avenues that people can use. You know, there are groups of Israelis or pro-Israeli activists. There's a site called Movers. There's a site called can't remember the other name, or something like Swords of Iron or something like that. Words of Iron, that was it. So these are actual groups of people who go around reporting and who have systems that vacuum up all of this pro-Palestinian content and links, and people go and they report them and they comment against them. And it's part of their huge Hasbro initiative. And it comes from so many different angles that it's meant to catch it in some way. It's meant to be suppressive. That's exactly the purpose of it.
Indeed. I wanted to shift the conversation a little, talk about how workers inside the tech industry are organizing against this, are saying, our labor should not be used in, to further a genocide of people, or to help law enforcement, or, the Unit 8200 target, just kind of mass target people for execution. Can you talk a little bit about Tech for Palestine and what your colleagues and comrades are up to? I know there was a nationwide protest yesterday by Google employees against Project Nimbus, which is something that that we've covered a few times over the last couple of years. Talk about that and what Tech for Palestine is doing right now.
Yeah, that was a wonderful initiative put together by No Tech for Apartheid, which is a collection of primarily Google, but also Amazon workers who are fighting against Project Nimbus, which is has been directly implicated in the Lavender situation that we were talking about earlier. The documents came out, and when I say came out, they were, I believe, No Tech for Apartheid helped reveal them, where they said that actually Google servers are running the AI algorithms that are killing Palestinians. So there's this connection between the work that workers do and the this direct connection with the killing that's happening in Palestine. And so No Tech for Apartheid put together this wonderful day of action. You can see the videos online of all of them being arrested and led away. And I've heard that they also had all of their access to networks be removed, to corporate networks, which is probably, means they're either being suspended or possibly being fired, and that will of course lead to legal action. Google fired a Google worker who stood up at the Mind the View conference, which was a pro-Israeli tech conference in New York about a month ago. And his name was Eddie Hatfield, and he got fired fairly shortly afterwards. So, Google is railing from these allegations because, it goes against their internal code of conduct, which says that their tools cannot be used for violence. And so there's an awful lot of obscuring, again, what it is they do. They don't know what their customers are doing. They don't know what their clients are doing, is the narrative that they say. But as documents come out that show that they do, in fact, know what's happening, and that there is a lot of complicity within Google in a similar way as there was to Meta. So that's wonderful work by No Tech for Apartheid. Tech for Palestine is a slightly different approach. Our approach is to build and scale up projects that are either advocating for Palestine or that are directly fighting in some way. For example, boycotts are one of the big subgenres of projects that we produce. We're 3 months old, so there's been a lot of change and a lot of sort of iterating based on what's been working and what's not. Today, the main thing that we do is that we're an incubator. We are incubating projects and really helping them try to figure out distribution and really have a high impact and focus on scale. A lot of the projects that we were seeing at the start were being built, and then there's a website that says this now, or there's something that does this now. And we're really trying to focus them on how do we actually get into the mainstream narrative. How can people think about the projects as bigger distribution mechanisms? And we're doing that by connecting projects, in some cases with leaders, In some cases with mentors, in many cases with volunteers. We have a volunteer database of people who want to help, and a lot of that is technical. Some of that is professional. So if you want a researcher, you want a software engineer, and you know many other things, project manager, designer, all that sort of thing. We have a database of it that we're providing to these projects in order to be able to scale up.
And Paul, I'm looking at the Tech for Palestine website and to the list of projects that you're currently working on. And I'll just give some examples. There's one called Books for Palestine, which is described as a toolkit and database of pro-Palestinian books activists can use for promotion. There's another one called, which I'm very interested in, Genocide Lawsuit Tracker, a website to publicize and support genocide-related lawsuits worldwide. And you've got all sorts of other ones. One here called Migrate Off Wix. Wix, many people may know, is an Israeli company that makes it easy for people to build websites. If you've got your own business or store or restaurant and you want to put up a website, a lot of people use Wix without knowing even that it's an Israeli company. So I suppose it's self-explanatory there, helping people to migrate off Wix. The question I want to ask you, and I'm excited to see how all these tools and all these projects develop. But the question I want to ask you, when we spoke to you a few months ago, we talked about the enormous backlash you faced and others faced for speaking out about this genocide. You really rang the alarm bell about the complicity and the silence and the fear in the tech sector, which is enormous. And as much as we may hate to admit it, our lives are dominated by what comes out of the tech sector. I see a lot of frustration from people. You know, we can't avoid these tools. I mean, we're learning about how Google is complicit, how Facebook may be complicit, how WhatsApp may be complicit. I mean, WhatsApp is our main tool for staying in touch with people in Gaza. There's really no avoiding it. So, you know, that's the sort of dilemma and the paradox we live in. So I guess the question I want to ask you is what have you seen a difference over the last 6 months of this horrifyingly ongoing genocide? Is there a shift in the conversation? Are people more willing to speak out? Clearly some are, because you've got thousands of people involved in Tech for Palestine. But what's the big picture here?
I think big picture, the narrative shift across the United States has been ginormous. It is... So, you know, it's difficult to overstate how much of a shift there has been from something where, you know, you simply could not speak up for Palestinians at all in October, and where my blog post, you know, made waves in December because, you know, no one else was speaking up about it, you know, to today. I mean, I think that the most recent huge change was after the World Central Kitchen, aid workers were being killed. You know, there have been a ton of things that have moved the needle significantly. You know, another one is the self-immolation of Aaron Bushnell last month. You know, there's a ton of, you know, small things like that have significantly changed the narrative. In terms of tech, I think the narrative has not shifted nearly enough, and I think that it's going to be a really long-term project to make it shameful to be Zionist within tech. And I think that that's where we really need to go. It's something where, you know, it's going to take a lot of boycotts. It's going to take, you know, boycotting the main things that BDS is boycotting, but also, you know, as you saw in our projects, you know, Wix. And WhatsApp, you know, the idea that we would keep on using these tools that are, you know, reporting where we should be blown up, you know, it's a ludicrous idea that we would keep using using WhatsApp, for example, or that we would keep using Wix, because that's something that props up the Israeli economy, and you know, it's a huge Israeli success story. So that, you know, ultimately what we are going to have to do in tech is you know, look at every single place where power is concentrated for Israel, and that's an awful lot of them, as I mentioned earlier, venture capital, their own startup ecosystem. Many Silicon Valley startups are also founded by Israelis and you know, former IDF members. So there's an awful lot of places where it's going to have to be. And I think so far what we've seen is a solid baseline of narrative shift. So when we started Tech for Palestine, I thought, you know, we can change tech and that will help change the U.S. And actually what's happening is the opposite. The U.S. is shifting at a much, much greater rate than tech. And so I guess we're going to have to use the U.S. shift narrative shift to change tech.
Just before we let you go, I just have a question that I'm curious about. If WhatsApp is not the most secure, what you know, what communication texting software do you personally recommend for people?
Almost all activists that I know use Signal.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of my conversations around Palestine and around organizing around Palestine happen in Signal groups. All of the protests I attend, they're all on Signal. You know, Signal is the place to be.
Excellent. Thanks for that. And if people want to get involved with Tech for Palestine, how can they do so?
So techforpalestine.org. At the moment, I think we still have people go into the Discord to volunteer, but we are putting up volunteer forms on the website. And really, you know, people who have any sort of skills at all, you know, if you're technical, wonderful. If you're not technical, you know, there's the skills that you bring, you know, translation, research, you know, even legal and policy work, you know, that great many skills that people can bring to projects that are extremely valuable. So right now it's very much join the Discord and we'll figure out how to connect you. But I will say that we are a 3-month-old project. There's a lot of things up in the air and there's a lot of things flapping in the wind sometimes. So we are doing our best.
Excellent. Well, you're doing amazing work. Thank you so much, Paul Bigar. You're a software engineer and the founder of Circle CI and Darklang, and recently of Tech for Palestine at techforpalestine.org. That's the coalition that now includes thousands of tech industry professionals who support Palestinian freedom. Paul, thank you so much. And please come back on very soon. I know there's always a lot to talk about in the sector.
For sure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paul. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. We wanted to bring on John Elmer for the Resistance Report. Hey, John.
Hi, guys.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Great. Another great show.
Thank you. And a lot that has been going on the ground. And so you've been very busy you're always busy, but you've been particularly busy.
Yes, we've been particularly busy the last week. There's no question about that.
Yeah,
absolutely. All right, well, yeah, go for it.
Yeah,
Take it away.
All right. So we're going to start in the Gaza Strip, appropriately. We're going to start in Khan Yunis. And as Nora said in the news report, while the ground war in Gaza has curtailed because of the Israelis leaving Khan Yunis after the 4-month operation in Khan Yunis, failed operation in Khan Yunis, failed ground invasion of Khan Yunis, the resistance attack, the Qassam Brigade's ambush that we covered on the show last week, chased the Israelis from Khan Yunis, and they left most of the areas of the south, and are just now, the Israelis are only along the corridor, the Netzarim Junction corridor that splits the Gaza Strip in half. And over the last the last 24 hours, 36 hours, the Israelis re-entered Beit Hanun in the northeast, which is the first place that the Israelis entered the Gaza Strip. And they're now returning to that area. People reported being besieged in the school, mass arrests of anyone over the age of 14 years old. And we're also just seeing this the terrible crimes that are being unearthed literally at Shifa Hospital, just brutal from a couple weeks ago's show. They're still digging bodies out that were buried by the Israeli army during the siege on Shifa Hospital, people with their medical equipment still attached to them, IV drip still attached, because Israel executed in the courtyard of Shifa Hospital patients. And the reason why they know where to dig right now, where they're digging for the mass graves, is because there's witnesses of the massacre at Shifa Hospital. Massacres in the middle camps that Nora reported on, of children in a playground. In Gaza City today, a massacre of people in an internet tent trying to get an internet in one of the few places in Gaza that you can get an internet signal that was reliable. Massacres there. So while the ground operation has curtailed, the aerial war is what is deadly for Palestinians. And in this period of time, the death rate in Gaza has barely changed. And that's the dangerous element of this in-between period where Israel carries out this war from the air. So let's start with an operation in Khan Yunis. Saraya Al-Quds released this video the other day from Khan Yunis. This operation obviously took place before the Israelis left. We're looking at a sniper team here operating a Dragunov rifle. And you can see the spotter and the shooter. We're editing, as Paul said. We're self-censoring here. We're editing the hit on this soldier, and we're editing him falling. But this is a sniper operation in Khan Yunis that Saraya Al-Quds showed us. And we see the triangle of the soldier here. This is during, this is before the Israelis left Khan Yunis. So this is from about a week and a half ago. Saraya Al-Quds sometimes takes a little bit longer to get their videos out than Qassam, who we saw were able to turn around their videos still after, you know, 6 months of war, 5 months of ground war. Qassam and Saraya Al-Quds still have the ability to not only carry out these operations, but to then, but to have their media arms distribute them. And this has been a crucial part of how we've covered this war the whole time. Is from videos from the resistance that they're giving to us with their media embedded into these units. And so we see in this video that the spotter and the cameraman are part of this operation. As you can see here, the spotter with his binoculars and the shooter. And this is something, these sniper operations are something that we have seen consistently and we will continue to see, because they're able to reach the distance of the buffer zone. And so they're able to reach Israeli soldiers in the buffer zone. Gaza is so small that any Israeli presence in the buffer zone is within reach of the resistance. And these videos have shown us, and again, this is Saraya Al-Quds, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad, carrying out this operation. The Israelis did not claim any casualties on this operation, but again, the video tells the story as it has throughout this entire war. So maybe we can go to the next one after this here, Tamar. Number two is, this is in East Jabalia. So we go from Khan Yunis in the south to east of Jabalia, which is in the north. And we see a Saraya Al-Quds fighter here talking to the camera and saying to the Israelis, this is just before they re-entered Beit Hanun, saying to the Israelis that they're here. The fighter says on camera here that we're here, we're waiting for you, and we're ready for you. These forces are not degraded in invisibly degraded. These operations are still being able to be carried out. This is the spotter here for this heavy machine gun attack, showing us that's an automatic machine gun post on the Israeli border. And you can see him with his Dishka 50 cal heavy machine gun. Now, this weapon that we're seeing used here, pointing out that this is also an Israeli position behind the berm there. You see this weapon mounted on the back of the pickup trucks on October 7th that went into Israel. It's a weapon that you see on the back of pickup trucks all over the world, called a technical when they put them on it. But this is a Soviet weapon, a heavy machine gun, that has a range of 2 kilometers. And so everyone in the buffer zone from the edge of East Jabalia here, Israeli positions in the buffer zone are able to be reached by the resistance. And again, this is a fighter who's obviously aware of the narrative that's happening. They're obviously still communicating directly because this fighter here is telling the Israelis that when they come back, that they'll be ready for them, that they're there waiting for them. While their Israelis are massacring children playing on a playground or sending quadcopters of crying babies to try to get Palestinians to come out of their house. Incidentally, that crying baby quadcopter only works because Palestinians do come out and help people constantly. And we see it in every single footage that we see from Gaza, people running towards the massacres to help people out immediately. We see people digging people out with their hands because there's no heavy machinery, because the Israelis went around and systematically destroyed the heavy machinery so the civil defense crews couldn't dig people out of the rubble. And so we're seeing that. And we saw people along the border, as Nora reported, trying to go home to the north. And Israelis shot those civilians. But we see the fighters here still able to operate. And so I think it's always interesting when Sarah Al-Quds puts these fighters' dialogues in, because you can see that they're still communicating. They're still able to get information and really communicate directly with the narratives that are happening on the ground. So this preceded the Israeli reinvasion of the north. And this is what we're going to see, I think, for the coming weeks and months, maybe, that the Israelis will operate on these raids. They called Shifa Hospital raid. They called it the gold standard of urban warfare. So this is the kind of idea that Israel plans to carry on with as we go forward here. So we can't see the result of this operation, but we still see the same weapons being deployed and still able to produce these videos. And let's go to number three, Tamara. This is another interesting operation that we've been following throughout the course of this war. This is Qassam. This is Sarah Al-Quds, Islamic Jihad. This is in Khan Yunis, and we see them again here with another Israeli quadcopter, commercial quadcopter that has been landed by the resistance. We see Qassam and Sarah Al-Quds both doing this, landing these quadcopters. You can see he's showing you the camera there on the video for the listeners. And for people listening, we're looking at a perfectly intact quadcopter. We see there on the wall indicating the day that it happened, showing that they're able to produce these videos immediately. The notice on the wall was the same day as the video was produced. And we're looking at a quadcopter that's unscratched. Again, clearly pointing out that the resistance is able to, presumably they're using GPS spoofing, they're jamming the signal and then using GPS spoofing to land these helicopters under their control. So they're using the terminology in their field reports that they took control of, is how the language of the field reports is. And this is the first video that we're watching here. This is the first video that we've seen the resistance actually film the drone in the air before landing it, which I think is one of the reasons they haven't been doing that is operational security for the method with which they're using to down these, which we don't know. They haven't shared that with us. But you can see, again, this is a second drone. This is in the middle camps now. They can do it from the north to the south of Gaza, and we're looking at a perfectly pristine, intact, not even scratched quadcopter. So it's clear that whatever is happening in the GPS spoofing, jamming process that the resistance is using is that they're able to take over these drones and completely land these quadcopters intact. These are commercial drones. It's not totally clear to me what the Israelis are using this for beyond what we all know they're using them for, which is to shoot their TikTok videos, because they have, of course, Israel is one of the world leaders in drones. They have many different types of drones that that they deploy with encryption and systems that would protect in some way against this kind of electronic warfare that we're seeing happen. But you can see he's pulling out this. It looks like it's basically brand new. These are not falling out of the sky. They're not being shot out of the sky, although we've seen that as well, of course. Both of those things we've seen before on video throughout this war. But very interesting development that they're still able to do this and have been able to do this throughout the course of the war. I think we'll probably hear more about it after the war. But able to take down these quadcopters without a scratch. It's pretty remarkable. And then you can see there, that's footage of it in the air, that their fighters are able to video it right over top of them. And that's the first time that Saraya Al-Quds or Qassam has shown us the drones in the air. I don't know if that gives clues to the Israelis about the system that they're using, but they clearly don't seem to be worried about that, because this was part of a video that they released this week. And again, the language that they've been using throughout the war is that they take control of them. They're commandeering the signal and landing these quadcopters. And then we've seen Saraya Al-Quds do this. We haven't seen Qassam do it, probably for operational security, but we've seen Saraya Al-Quds take out the data cards and use the footage that the drone is capturing. So three interesting operations, all from the last week released. Again, we're still doing videos that are only from the last week, and we're still able to do that to cover the war. So that's the Gaza Strip, where the resistance is carrying on. Consistently, we also saw a sniper attack yesterday in the north from the Qassam brigades, and the Israelis admitted that a Shaldag Air Force Special Forces soldier was seriously wounded in an operation in the north. And I think based on the operations that the Israelis are doing in the Netzarim Junction, where they're expanding the buffer zone that divides the Gaza Strip in half from north to south, there's been, as always, resistance along that corridor. Anytime the Israelis are present, there's resistance. And that's also the case in the West Bank. We'll take a look here at a video from Tubas in the central north West Bank. And we're watching fighters here with the West Bank videos. This is Saraya Al-Quds Tubas Brigade. And we're seeing these videos linking up an IED here, improvised explosive device. They're wiring it up and they're talking about the ambush, which is now we're looking at the fighters with their guns getting ready, because it's a complex ambush. They set the IED against an armored bulldozer. And then their fighters are moving here, waiting for the bulldozer to hit that IED that's planted. This is Tamun Junction, outside of Tubas, outside of the camp, the refugee camp, where there's been battles. There's basically, as Abdul Jawad said the other day, there's an intifada for sure in the north of the West Bank. There's armed struggle throughout the West Bank, but the pace and intensity of operations, it was 85 resistance operations in the West Bank just last week. This is one of 9 IEDs. There was 16 shooting operations. And if you include demonstrations and that there was more than 34 ops a day last week, including the demonstrations. We know that settlers, as Nora said, the settlers have been taking advantage of this situation in Gaza and in after the Iran missile attack to increase their violence. So what we see in the built-up areas in the West Bank is armed struggle, and then what we see in the countryside is the settlers working with the army to continue these attacks in the countryside. So resistance in the refugee camps has been fierce, and these IEDs are developing and they're clearly getting better, and they're all over the West Bank. So this is an operation from Tubas in the north of the West Bank that I wanted to bring you guys. And we're seeing here, we've taken out the audio again, as Paul said, to try to beat these the censorship that's happening. But we're seeing there on the camera, the camera's jostling because the fighters are firing on the bulldozer. So it's a complex operation that happened in the West Bank. So I just wanted to bring you guys that from the West Bank. And then we did a show on Sunday about the Iranian missile attack on Saturday night in Palestine, Operation True Promise, which was an unprecedented, the first time that Iran has struck Israel from its territory to Israeli territory directly, not using allies to carry out this attack. It was a response. Operation True Promise is what the Iranians called it, and it's a true promise to respond to the Israeli assassination of the two two Quds Force generals, Iranian generals, that were assassinated in Damascus, in the consulate in Damascus, on April 1st. And so the key attributes that we talked about on Sunday about this operation were that it was telegraphed. So there was 2 weeks preparation. The Americans were able to reposition their forces. They were able to set up an alliance that included the UK, France, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States. And the Iranian attack even was announced before it was launched. Iranian state television said that the operation will begin soon. So we had a lot of warning for this, and Iran said that the missile attack was part of their part of Article 51 of the UN Charter, the right of self-defense. And it's also the assassination on the consulate in Damascus is seen as Iranian territory. So Iran responded with an attack on Israel. So let's take a look at some of these images here, because the attack began by clearing airspace. And so there was a lot of firsts in this missile attack operation, but this is one of the first tests that we've seen of the attempt to drop, to use electronic warfare, to drop the GPS and GNSS, the Russian GPS signal that the Iranian missiles and drones work on. And so we can see here, this is flight tracker footage of showing essentially a corridor from Iran to Israel completely, planes were completely grounded. And this is part of the electronic warfare test that we had never seen before on this scale. And people in the Middle East are still talking about GPS being messed up in the Middle East. Planes are complaining about it because their navigation systems aren't working. People's cell phones all say that they're at Beirut Airport. People in Middle Eastern countries are getting Israeli dating apps, like switching their location of their dating apps and getting Israeli positions. And a lot of these GPS spoofings that the Israelis are using are channeled through bases in Israel. So it's obvious that this is an Israeli part of this Israeli electronic warfare plan. And let's take a look at, so there was three major elements to this operation. There was unmanned aerial vehicles, and this is what we're looking at here. This is the Shahed drone. This is a fiberglass drone, propeller flown, rocket launched, and it's a fiberglass drone, and so that makes the radar and the heat signature off of this are very low, and so they're difficult to track on radar. And so the GPS, the dropping of the GPS systems and the Russian GPS system was an attempt by Israel to drop these drones before they entered Israeli airspace. They also used fighter jets to shoot down these drones. And that was what they used in an alliance. There's still a lot about this operation that we don't know, but according to Israeli figures, there was 350 missiles and drones, and 185 of them were these Shahed drones, and we'll see those in action coming up. The main targets, just to give you the main targets of this operation, were pretty clearly three targets. There was a signals intelligence base in the Golan, which is run by Unit 8200 that Paul just talked about, and then two desert bases in the Negev desert. Nevatim Air Base, which is the home of the F-35s, and it's also, Nevatim is the air base that the Americans bring their weapons airlifts that have happened since October 7th. That base takes those airlifts, and also Ramon Air Base further south in the Negev, and that's a major Israeli base in the south. And so those are the three targets. They're very symbolic targets. They're well-defended targets, and they're targets that are in the desert. And so this is Iranian attack did not target cities. It did not target built-up areas in Israel. It targeted, apparently, pretty clearly, the Israelis showed footage of hits on Nevatim Air Base. And so Iran used three tools. They used these Shahed drones, and if we look at the next one, they use these cruise missiles. Those Shahed drones are about the speed of a car. They're about the cost of a car, and they fly low and slow. And so the launching of the attack, the Israelis had many hours to prepare their defenses. These are the cruise missiles that were launched. The Israelis say 36 of these cruise missiles were launched. And then there was 110 ballistic missiles. We don't know. We can't verify these numbers. Iran didn't say how many were fired. And of course, this is there's a lot of information warfare about this operation. A lot of fake videos by both sides.
Welcome back. And that was Electronic Intifada, military update in the last segment there from Gaza and the West Bank all the way to the Republic of Iran. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, April 19th, 2024. And we are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you would like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with the music of the legendary Eric Dolphy from the album entitled Far Cry. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.